my name's Hilda. I'm an alcoholic. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you're here, you're probably either the dedicated or the desperate, because there's good football on tonight, and we're here. Thank you, Lee, for asking me to come up, and Suzanne for chatting with me, always helpful. It's one of my least favorite things to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'll do anything that I'm asked of. Especially if it's Lee asking, because I know Lee will do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's an example for me. It's funny because before I was coming out, I had the telly on for a minute, and I saw the advertisement for the Christopher Robin Winnie the Pooh movie, you know. I'm a huge Winnie the Pooh fan. And it reminded me of this meeting. I was at a women's meeting once, and one of my sobriety sisters was sharing about how when she drank, she was Eeyore, right? Everything's terrible, tomorrow's going to be worse, you know? And I looked over at my sponsor and I was like, what? I was nowhere near Eeyore. I am Winnie the Pooh when I drink. Tomorrow is always going to be better. It's never as bad as you think it is. I'm not changing anything, but it's all going to change, you know? And then I started thinking about how Winnie the Pooh is like truly an alcoholic, right? Because it was always about eating the honey, getting over the honey, and getting more honey, right? Which is like what my drinking is like. You know, I'm either drinking, getting over drinking, or thinking about drinking. And then I realized that Winnie the Pooh is actually all about alcoholism, because if you think about it, you've got Eeyore, who's the depressive drunk. Then there's Winnie the Pooh. And then there's Tigger. Right? And Tigger is for those alcoholics who took things to make them go very fast. And, you know, and then I started thinking about Piglet, who is truly an untreated Al-Anon, right? And that just leaves Christopher Robin as the black belt Al-Anon. And, you know, I thought it's all about alcoholism, really. And then I was reading something. It was one of the Winnie the Pooh stories, and it was the time it was Eeyore's birthday. And Winnie the Pooh was going to take him a little pot of honey for his birthday. And as he's going over, he starts eating the honey, right? So by the time he arrives, he has licked the pot clean. And he says, I brought you a pot to store things in, you know? And that's so my drinking, you know. I might be taking you a 12-pack, but there'd be two when we arrived, you know. And that's just the kind of drunk I am. And, you know, I really love Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, when I drink, I am a lying bedwetting whore. I tried everything for that not to be true, but that's what happens when I drink. And so, if you haven't figured it out already, I wasn't born in Tahunga. I was born in London. I grew up in a pub. It was my granddad's pub, and I'm an only child, an only grandchild. And from a very early age, I loved everything to do with booze. I liked the shapes of the bottles and the colors and the fancy labels. And, you know, only children entertain ourselves well. And for me, the playground was the cellar, and I loved it. And I used to line whiskey bottles up on one side and vodka bottles on the other, and I'd have the whiskey bottle chatting to the vodka bottles, and they'd be chatting to me, and I'd be chatting to them. And, you know, whiskey was the bad guys, and vodka was the good guys. And not a lot of that changed in my 20s, but I loved it long before I tasted it, you know. And my granddad's pub, we lived upstairs, and he had tree bars downstairs, the front bar, because it was in the front, the cocktail bar where people went to after work and had a couple of drinks, and then the long bar out the back. And there was a little alleyway between the kitchen and the long bar, and my bedroom was above the kitchen, and it looked straight down into the long bar. And the long bar is where life happened. You know, they had pool tournaments and dart tournaments, and fights would break out, and the police would come. And from my bedroom window, it was better than telly. You know, I loved it. And after hours, my granddad would have the regulars stay. They had the thing called lock-in in London. And the regulars got locked in until my granddad went to bed, and they drank and played cribbage, and they turned the lights down. And from my bedroom window, all I could see was the neon lights glowing through the optics. And it was magic, you know. And I didn't know how old I was, but I snuck down one night, and I know my pajamas still had feet in them, you know. But my granddad put me up on a bar stool, and he gave me a baby sham. And at the time, baby sham came in a little bottle, and just like a sparkling wine or something. I was a little person, and even the logo on the baby sham was this cartoon deer kind of leaping, you know. And I'd arrived, you know. To this day, I don't know whether I got tipsy or I got drunk, or I have no clue if I even liked the taste. But I can tell you at that moment, I felt part of. You know, I've heard people in Alcoholics Anonymous, they talk about the effects produced by alcohol, and the book says, you know, alcoholics drink primarily for the effect. I know a lot of people are talking about getting drunk or, you know, all of those things that happen with drinking alcohol, but for me, the effect produced by alcohol is that I feel part of you. And that was magic for me, because I never felt part of, you know. And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about me really well around page 33, and I'm paraphrasing, but it basically says it doesn't matter how much you drink or how often you drink, it's what happens when you drink. And that many who are merely potential alcoholics often become the real thing in a relatively short amount of time, particularly true of women. And I'm one of those women. You know, by 16, I had an ulcer. At 17, I got done for drunk driving. At 18, I had a heart attack. And 6 months later, I was in my first mental hospital. And that's when drink was working, right? It all went downhill very fast after that. And over the next 3 years, I was in and out of 5 mental hospitals. The longest I was ever out of a mental hospital during that time was for 2 weeks. And in those 2 weeks, I had my own flat, had the curtains drawn, the answering machine on, a fridge full of Osti, Spumante, vodka, and Michelob Light. Because I'm a calorie counter, too. And, you know, I did not see or speak to another human being for 2 weeks, and I was happy. I have a clear memory of standing in the shower, drinking a cold Mic Light, not knowing if it was day or night, not caring, and thinking it just doesn't get any better than this, you know? But what happened was I got a knock on the door one day, and it was my mom, my shrink, 2 policemen, and 2 nurses, and they shot me in the arse with something and put me in a jacket with really long arms. And I came to at the Institute for the Living in Hartford, Connecticut. And I felt a bit like I'd been punked or something, you know. It was a little surreal because I found out I'd been committed for a minimum of a year for being a danger to myself and others. Now, I hadn't seen anybody for 2 weeks. I couldn't figure out who the others were. And it really bothered me, you know, because the people in those places are crazy. Now, I've always known there was something a little off with me. You know, just that little bubble off normal, not quite right. You know what I mean? I've never been a full ticket. I don't think I'm ever going to be a full ticket. And quite honestly, I do not believe there is a program in the world that will make me a full ticket. What I do know is that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the tools that allow me to act as if I'm a full ticket. And I'm running with that today, but at the time, I knew there was something wrong, and I knew they didn't know what it was. But I had this roommate, and it was really obvious what was wrong with her, right? I mean, she had rage attacks. One minute she'd be fine, and then she'd snap. She'd start punching out windows and going for nurses. It'd be chaos. And they did this thing called wet packing, where all these nurses would tackle her to the floor, wrap her in cold, wet sheets, and toddle her away. Now, she had something I didn't have, and that was friends locally. And her friends used to smuggle money in all the time. So when she got toddled away, I'd start thinking. Because I'm a thinker, right? I started thinking it seems such a waste to leave all that money sitting around, you know. So I went AWOL on her dime. And the first time I went AWOL, I had $50 on me, and I ended up in downtown Hartford, and I had no clue what I was going to do. And this little fellow wandered up to me, and he said, do you want to buy a ticket to Prince? Now, I didn't know who Prince was. I am truly an AC/DC Black Sabbath kind of girl. But I'm thinking a dark auditorium, this might work, you know. So I get these tickets, I smuggle in 2 bottles of vodka, I'm sitting in the nosebleed seats, and while he did his little raspberry beret thing, I got absolutely legless. And after the concert, I was wandering around Hartford, and I ended up in this park with these fellas passing a bottle. Pretty sure they were winos. But they were good as gold, and they let me drink with them. And they never said a word. They just kept looking at me like stupid or crazy. But they were good as gold. And then as dawn came, the white van with the blue letters pulled up, Institute for the Living. And I stood up and said, I gotta go, my ride's here. And true story. And these fellas just looked at me like, yep, crazy. So I get back to the hospital and I got to build up my little trust points, and anybody who's been in an institution like that knows the deal. And, you know, as time was going, I wasn't going as far. And one of the last times I went AWOL, I ended up in this pizza joint around the corner from the hospital. And when I went in, I was like, okay, Hilda, this time we are going to do this like a lady. We're going to do this properly. So I go in, I order a slice of pizza and 2 pitchers of beer. I sit down in the booth and I start pouring it in the glass like a lady. But some of the nurses from my unit came in on their break. So now I'm down in the booth with the pitcher up to my mouth, trying to get as much down me as I can before I'm seen, you know. It was just crazy. So when my year was coming up, I had to go before a board of psychiatrists, and my psychiatrist stood up and said, Hilda will never live in normal society. She is completely incapable. And his recommendation was that I do a minimum of another year. And it took me 2.5 months to convince the board to let me out. So I did 14 and a half months. And in hindsight, I think you may have had a point. Because I got out, I moved from Hartford to Hamden, which was just down the road. I got a little job and I met a fella. And this fella turned out to be a Coke dealer. And I didn't know anything about Coke. I didn't know that it would help you drink longer. Those of you nodding did. I did not. But I tell you what happened in a relatively short amount of time. I've got this little job at $700 a week. I have a Coke habit of $1,500 a week. And when you do the math, it wasn't coming out terribly well. And I was sitting on the counter in my kitchen one day, and I looked out at my flat. I was drinking McLite at the time. And I remember thinking, I had sold everything, including my curtains, for Coke. And I thought, Hilda, if we are hanging out with people who will buy your curtains, we have a problem here. Do you know, I never did Coke again. In fact, I'd be in parties and people around me would be doing Coke, and my little head would go, mm-mm-mm, remember the curtains. Now, I think that's what makes me a real alcoholic, because far worse things happen to me drinking than ever happened to me with Coke. And never once did my head ever say, don't drink. What it might say is, stay away from the whiskey because it makes you mean. You know, don't be drinking the red wine because it makes you cry. My version of chapter 3, switching from Scotch to Brandy or Scott to Randy. But it never actually said, don't drink, right? So I'm in Hamden, I get done for drunk driving, drunk and disorderly, indecent exposure, and I think, you know, I never should have left England. It was so much better there. And I'd move back to England, and I wouldn't be in England very long, and I get done for drunk driving, drunk and disorderly, indecent exposure, and I think, you know, America was so much better. What was I thinking? And really, that's my drinking in a nutshell. It was always going to be better somewhere else, and everywhere I went, there I was. And I have a long list of arrests for indecent exposure. I know I don't look the type today. Maybe a little. But something happens when you add alcohol to my type of alcoholic, and I know I'm not alone in Alcoholics Anonymous because I've heard plenty of women share. But as soon as you add alcohol to my type of alcoholic, for whatever reason, I just know that you must see my tits. Now, I tried everything for that not to be true. And I know that it's part of my alcoholism because I don't feel the need to show them to you now. So So I'm back and forth and back and forth, and I'm back in England at this time, and I'm tending bar with my mate Andy. Andy and I have been great friends for a long time, and Andy's birthday was on New Year's Eve, so we started drinking on Christmas Eve, as you do. And, you know, I've always been a blackout drinker. I used to call it losing time. I was always losing time. I might lose a couple hours, I might lose a couple of days, but I was always losing time. And I had assumed that when I had lost time, I had passed out quietly somewhere. I found out on the 3rd of January that that was not true. Because Andy called me and he asked me if I was ready to pick out rings. And I had no clue what he was talking about. And he said, no, no, Hilda, not this time. Now, he brought over a video. I'm on this video and I look great. I look great. I am not slurring my words. I'm not walking funny. It was all these different pubs we were in. All our friends were there. My father was there. I'm watching the video, and Andy went down on one knee, and I thought, dear God, say no, because I wasn't there. And it was the first time I realized that you didn't know that I didn't know that I wasn't there, you know. So I did what I did best, really. I went to the pub, and I found the guy in the pub that knows everything about everything. This guy is in every bar all over the world, right? There's some of you here tonight, I know. You know, he's the fella you ask what time it is, and he explains exactly how the pendulum clock really works, right? So I'm chatting away to him, and, you know, I told him I'm engaged, I don't know what to do, and he said, did you know if you volunteer on a kibbutz in Israel, they give you 3 meals a day, they do your laundry, and you get 50 quid a month? And I thought, result? 3 days later, I'm in Golders Green, I've got a visa, I'm going to Israel. I'm a good Irish Catholic girl. This all made sense to me. So I went to Israel, and I went for 3 months. I stayed 9, and I come out of a blackout in a Tel Aviv jail charged with drunk driving. And I didn't remember renting the car, and I can tell you that really horrible things happen to young, vulnerable women who drink like I do in places like that. And I got out on bail, and I jumped bail, and I went to Egypt, and I ended up with the wrong people in the wrong place at the wrong time. And really horrible things happen to young, vulnerable women who drink like I do in places like that. And I ended up getting dumped in Cairo, just near the American embassy. Everything was shut because it was Ramadan, and a big American Marine took pity on me. Him and his mates looked after me until the embassy opened, and you know, I truly believe a non-alcoholic woman who had been through what I had been through would probably never drink again. But I'm a goalpost drinker. I'm one of those drinkers that says if it gets bad, I just move the goalpost back a little bit more. I think if it gets worse, I just move the goalpost back a little bit more. You know, I got an emergency passport. I was in 20 minutes in the air. I thought, hell, they could have killed me. I was drunk when I landed. And I didn't know it was alcoholism. I had no clue. And the whole kind of 80s for me are like one big long blackout with little bits of reality tossed in. And coming to the end of the 80s, I found out I was in a relationship. And apparently I'd been in for quite a while. You know, the 80s for me were a bit like the Talking Heads song, Once in a Lifetime, where he goes, this is not my beautiful house. This is not my beautiful wife. How did I get here? It's just madness. And my partner was commenting on my drinking, which I just thought was rude. So I moved to Nebraska. I moved in with me mom. And I wasn't with me mom very long, and she started commenting on me drinking. And I really didn't know what I was going to do, and I thought about my uncle. Now, my uncle had tried to 12-step me when I was 18 in a pub in St. Albans. He was 9 months sober, and he was on fire with Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was buying the beer, so I let him talk, you know. But I remember him saying, in Alcoholics Anonymous, you need never drink again. I was 18. I thought, why wouldn't I want to drink? But he could see where I was going. And of course, fast forward, it's all gone horribly wrong. I thought about him. And he was still sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, my uncle was what I thought a real alcoholic was, right? My uncle went to prison. I only ever went to jail, right? My uncle went to detox centers. I only ever went to mental hospitals. So in my mind, he was what a real alcoholic was, but he was still sober, so I thought I'd give it a go. And I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on New Year's Eve, 1989. I picked New Year's Eve because I truly believe no real alcoholic would quit drinking on New Year's Eve. I know today only alcoholics mark the calendar. Non-alcoholics never do that. They never think about their drinking. They don't put little red X's on calendars. You know, it's like virgins don't go for pregnancy tests. It doesn't happen, you know. I didn't know that, but I went to this meeting on New Year's Eve, and it was a little meeting in Papillion, Nebraska, and they were talking about, he's the father, we're the children, and I thought I was screwed, because I know that's not the answer. I mean, I'm a seeker. I've always been a seeker. I mean, Israel, please, right? So I can't hear anything else they're saying, and I started taking everybody's inventory by their shoes, because I can't look at you either. And the fella next to me had on the biggest pair of cowboy boots I'd ever seen. And I'm thinking, I wonder if his IQ is any bigger than his boot size. You know, just tearing these people to shreds in my head. And of course, after the meeting, I made a beeline for my car, and this big, dumb cowboy followed me out. And he says to me, have you got a big book? I said, of course I have a big book. Doesn't everybody have a big book? Now, I wouldn't have known a big book if you'd beat me to death with it, but I couldn't tell him that, you know. But without missing a beat, he went to his truck, and he gave me his big book. And it was the first time anybody'd seen straight through me. And I was speechless, and as I went to get in my car, this little old woman ran up to me and said, did you know if you go to a lot of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and you don't drink in between, you can't get drunk? I was like, thank you? I got in my car, I thought, these people are freaks. But that little woman's voice kept resonating in my head, and I thought, hang on a minute, she may have a point here. If I went to a lot of meetings and I didn't drink in between, I might stay out of trouble. That's what was attractive to me. That's exactly what I did. I went to a lot of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and my life took off. It's a rocket to stardom in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you have any time in here at all, you know who I'm talking about. Right? My cars are getting better. My jobs are getting better. The money's coming in. I'm in dry clean only clothes. Coming 5 minutes late, leaving 5 minutes early, calling it a home group. Right? I'm listening to you share about the steps thinking, wow, I'm glad you have those. You need them. You know, I thought the steps were for those of you who are really unwell. There seem to be a lot of you. And I got a sponsor because people were giving me a hard time about not having one, right? You know what they're like. So I found the oldest, frailest woman I could find. Because I thought she wouldn't give me a hard time. Yeah, I was wrong. She really tried. She really did. And what happened was I was about 3 years sober. And she got really ill, and she was dying in hospital, and I went to see her, and she said to me, just remember, Hilda, Alcoholics Anonymous will be here for you when you come back. I hadn't drank yet. I had no clue what she was talking about, but she could see exactly what was happening. And of course, she passed away, and I pulled away. Went from 7 meetings a week to 5 to 4 to 3 to a week to a month, because now I'm very busy. And I'm not going to Wednesday night because I can't stand the secretary. And I'm not going to Friday night because the same woman shares the same shite every week and I can't listen to her anymore. Now I'm taking AA's inventory. And of course, the reality is I sat in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous dying of alcoholism. And I didn't know. I didn't know. So I'm on the beach in Florida. I'm on my way to my dream job in Germany, the job I had worked very hard for, which I never should have got. And my partner had come back because I wasn't drinking. We're walking on the beach, and she turned to me and said, you know what? Not only do I not like you, I don't love you drunk or sober. And I thought, are you kidding? 3.5 years, I haven't had a drink for you, which was my utter problem. So I took my now ex to the airport, and as the plane took off, I walked in the bar. I started with double Jack, because that's how I drink. Started drinking on the Thursday, arrived in Germany on the Sunday, started my new job on the Monday, got done for drunk driving on the Friday, and woke up in a wet bed next to my new boss on Saturday morning. That's my drinking. Glamour drinking. I drank like that for 9 months. And you know, I've heard people share from podiums that if you want to pick up where you left off, pick up a drink tomorrow. absolutely not my experience. When I started drinking after not drinking, my drinking was 10 times worse and more. My blackouts were longer. The people I woke up next to were uglier. The beds were wetter. It was not pretty. And on the morning after what I hope is my last night before, it's the 20th of July, 1993. It is my sobriety day. I woke up in my own bed, which had become a bonus. I was alone, which was a bigger bonus. But the bed was wet, and I was still dressed from work, and this is all very normal for me. But when I got up and I went into the bathroom, my hose were all ripped. There was blood everywhere. I had a great gash in my face, and I had no clue what had happened the night before. And I had a moment. Remember those people in Alcoholics Anonymous sharing about the hideous four horsemen? Terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. And I think, God, you're so dramatic. That morning, I knew who they were, and my heart broke. Not because I can't drink anymore. I drink with the best of them. But that morning, I realized I had become unpredictable to me. I did not care when I was unpredictable to you. But that morning, I realized things had changed, and I didn't know what else to do but call English-speaking AA. And a fella called Steve Baker answered the phone. He lets me break his anonymity. And I told him my sad old story, been to AA, screwed it up, wine, wine, wine. And he said something to me I truly believe saved my life. He said, you know, Hilda, the most natural thing in the world for an alcoholic to do is drink. That's why in Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't shoot our wounded. And I believed him. It was the only reason I went to a meeting that night was because I thought he understood. So I'm driving over to this meeting in Hunsbrück, Holland, and my head kicks in. And my head goes, hang on a minute, Hilda. We don't want anybody to think we're new. Right? I don't want anybody to think I don't know what's going on in here. So I'm thinking about the meetings in California and Florida, big meetings where you could go in 5 minutes early, leave 5 minutes late, and 5 minutes late, leave 5 minutes early. And my plan was I was going to come in, sit at the back, get a little bit of time, and then tell you what happened. I walked into the meeting in Hunsbrück Hall, and there were 7 people in the room for an hour and a half. And nobody was letting me pass, right? So I told all them my sad old story. And it wasn't hard to see who the newcomer was, right? They're all shiny and new. I'm bloated, sweaty, big gash in my face. The vision for you. And after the meeting, they were looking for somebody to make the tea and coffee. And I was thinking, wow, I hope they find somebody. It's an important commitment. And this voice from across the room went, Hilda will do it. And I said, Hilda who? This meeting is Tuesday, Thursdays, and Saturdays. This was Tuesday night. I said, hang on a minute. I didn't know if I'm going to be sober on Thursday. That seemed like a long time to me. And this woman just looked at me and said, if you want to stay sober, you'll make the tea and coffee. Now, my head went, who is this psycho bitch and why is she tormenting me? But my mouth went, oh, okay. I had no fight left. If you're new, I hope you're tired. I would have done anything that woman suggested, and I tried, because I just didn't have a better plan, you know? And I didn't know if it was the Thursday or the Saturday, but one of the nights she pulled me aside and said, you know, you really should try and do 90 meetings in 90 days. I said, do you see where we are? Hunsbrück, Holland. It's like nowhere, hang a left. She goes, oh, I know where we are. But they have a meeting in Dusseldorf on Friday and Kaiserslautern on Wednesday and Dahan on Monday. I was like, I said, I'm not driving all over God's acre for a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not happening. She goes, huh, how far did you drive for a drink? Which is so unfair. Because I am that drunk at 2 a.m. driving around for anything open, right? So I started tormenting my home group because I had this thing about getting lost. Whenever I got lost, I got a B&B, a couple of bottles, and called it a day. I did it on the way to job interviews, weddings, my wedding once. I just couldn't do it. So on Thursday night, I'd say, I'm going to Dusseldorf tomorrow night. Does anybody want to go? The guy I hated the most. Hated. Always went, I'll go with you, Hilda. It's like, anybody but you, you know. But every Friday, Mike would show up and we would drive an hour and a half to Dusseldorf for an hour and a half's meeting, for an hour's coffee afterwards, and an hour and a half's drive home. And I wanted to kill him the entire time. I have left skid marks on the Autobahn where I pulled over to tell him to get out. But he was like 8 years sober and he would just laugh.
We're going to be late if you don't get going.
I'm grateful today for where I got sober because I learned principles before personalities, right? You have to when you hate your entire home group and they're all you've got. You know? And I was reading something in the book one night, and I can't remember what it was, but it was like 2 a.m. or something, and it prompted me to call the psycho woman. And she answered like she was waiting for it. It's creepy when that happens, isn't it? I said, "Sandy, I'm reading this bit in the book, and I think I need a sponsor. Would you sponsor me?" She said, "I have been, but thanks for making it official." Got my sponsor. And, you know, Sandy was good as gold. She dragged me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was in her house one night, and I was getting ready to go home, and I remember saying to her, "Look, Sandy, I'm wasting your time and mine because I'm a drunk. I always drink. And sooner or later, I'm going to drink." And she said to me, "You know, Helda, if you can truly put the steps as a practical application in your life, you never have the excuse of 'I've always been and I'm always going to be.' 6 and 7, take that away. You no longer have that excuse. You get to change." And she gave me hope that night. You know, and she really helped me apply that in my life. And I am so grateful. And somebody asked me not so long ago, what does that look like? You know, what does 6 and 7 look like practically applied? And it's really not that complicated. You know, one of my biggest character defects was arrogance, and I was always abusing checkout people. Sorry if there's any checkout people here, but I was. It was just my thing. I had a bad day and I would abuse them because I'm unmanageable. I'm at the grocery store every night of the week, you know, and I'm abusing Tracy every time I go to checkout. And Sandy just said to me, "Ask her how her day is." I said, "I don't care." She said, "Ask her anyway, you know." And I started talking to Tracy. And Julie was with me one day, and as we were leaving the grocery store, she said to me, "Do you realize you actually care about Tracy's day?" Not only did I care about her day, but I knew all about her son, who was special ed, and the soccer he played. And it was a small change, right? Acting myself into better thinking. And Sandy gave me all of that. And, you know, I was in her kitchen one day. She took me through the book line by line, page by page, and where there was an action, we took it. And, you know, I'm grateful for that. And we were reading this thing, and I said, "I know what it says, Sandy, but do you know what they mean?" And before I could enlighten her, her book came across the kitchen and just missed my head. And I said, "Jesus, Sandy, what are you doing?" She said, "No. When you read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you read the black bits. There's nothing in between the lines. What they say is what they mean." And of course, I'm a mumbler. I'm like, "I don't think so. I think there's more to it than that, you know." And how she didn't kill me. I was about 9 months sober and my company promoted me. They're sending me to Belgium. Belgium. So I went over to Sandy's. I said, "Sandy, they're sending me to Belgium." She said, "What's the problem, Helda?" I said, "I'm only 9 months sober. I'm not supposed to have any major changes in the first year." And she said, "Huh, I'm really sorry. Your company didn't get the memo. Pack your bags." So I moved to Belgium, and I was miserable in Belgium. So I tried duvet therapy, which I'm sure you've never done up here. That's when you get home from work, you get under the duvet, you get up the next day and hope it all changes. It didn't work, but I didn't drink. And I finally called Sandy and told her what was going on, and she told me to blow the dust off my big book and get my happy little arse 20 minutes up the road to the Brussels meeting, 7 nights a week. And when I got there, I was to share honestly. I was like, "Fine, whatever." So I drive up to Brussels, and when I got there, they had like almost no literature, and their coffee was like sludge. So when I shared, I told them so. And afterwards, they gave me the literature commitment and took me to coffee. And I learned how to put my hand out again. And, you know, they really saved my life in Brussels. And When I got offered the job in London, I did it all different. I went over every weekend. I had a home group before I arrived. I had a service commitment waiting for me when I got there. People in AA in London helped me find a flat. And I didn't have to do duvet therapy, and it all went really smooth. And I learned just that little bit about doing something different for a different result. I had heard you share about it, but I'd never actually done it. My sobriety hasn't really been textbook sobriety. I was about 2.5 years sober. I heard this speaker say you can do absolutely anything in Alcoholics Anonymous if you're willing to do the work and pay the price. And I thought, huh. So I went home, I quit my job, I went on the dole, and I started applying to universities. I'm going to go into a helping profession. I'm going to help people. 2.5 years sober, I did not know myself well enough to know that I don't like people enough to do that. But I started applying to universities, and when I was 4 years sober, I got into university, and I got my first tattoo, and I got my first motorcycle. And 4.5 years sober, I had a big motorcycle accident, so I got a bigger tattoo. And a bigger bike. And 5 years sober, I started my second year at university, and nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous seemed surprised. And I thought it was because you believed in me, and of course now I know it's that you believe in Alcoholics Anonymous, that you can do absolutely anything here if you're willing to pay the price and do the work. And I was tootling along quite nicely in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm 6.5 years sober, I'm sponsored, I'm sponsoring, life is good. And I was just about to leave for a convention and the phone rang and it was my mom. And my mom was living in Southern California and she'd been diagnosed with breast cancer. And she asked me if I would come out to Southern California when she had these big operations. And I said I would. And I went on to this convention and I'm standing in line for registration. And this fella who knew me when I first got sober pulled me aside and said, would you share at the midnight meeting? And I said, no, I'm really not up for it, to tell you the truth. And he said, actually, you look like you need to share. And I didn't realize that my outsides were starting to match me insides, you know. And he goes, look, Hilda, there'll be nobody there. The old-timers meeting is going on at the same time. I was like, fine, whatever. So I show up at this midnight meeting. There's 250 people in the room. And for the first time in 6.5 years, I cried in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had never cried. In fact, when you cried, I used to tap your knee, you know, sorry. I had no frame of reference, you know. But I cried when I shared about my mom. And something happened that night because a fella I barely knew stood up in the back of the room and offered me a flight to Los Angeles if I couldn't afford it. The fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous touched me that night. The first time I really realized that I was part of something bigger than a meeting, that I was part of a fellowship, and that I was in the middle of the bed. And so when the time came, I did go out to Southern California. Now, I had spent my entire sobriety to that point asking my sponsor, how do I make amends to this woman? My mom. I'm an only child. I tore my mother's heart out. I called her collect from foreign jails, and she could do nothing. And my sponsor kept saying, it's God's time, not yours. And when the time is right, you'll know. And so she was having these operations, and I made sure I was there when she woke up, and I was there when she went to sleep, and the old 202 Club in Pasadena was right across the street, and I went across to meetings when she was sleeping, and, you know, oddly enough, they say, is it odd or is it God? Oddly enough, because of what I had been doing at university, I got to take my mom home early and nurse her at home. And I was emptying her tubes one day, and my mom just turned to me and said, you know, I don't know how I'll ever repay you. I said, you don't get it. 6.5 years I had waited for that moment when I got to be the daughter she deserved instead of the one she had. And I love that thing. Life is not measured by the number of breaths you take, but by the moments that take your breath away. Because that's been my sobriety. It's not the years. It's those moments, you know. And my mom and I have a great relationship today. She just retired not so long ago. So we've entered a whole new our era, you know. She called me the other day. She said, I'm getting the internet delivered tomorrow. I said, no, you're not. She's a character. We just changed our phone carrier from AT&T to something else. So I had to, my mom's phone is on our thing, and I had to take her in so they could swap her phone over. And this young fella, I don't know, he looked 12. He said, he's doing her phone for her, you know, and she said, are you sure I don't need to buy a new phone? And I said, no, Mom, you don't need to buy a new phone. They're just going to swap the carrier over. It'll be fine. So she looks at the young fella and goes, do I need to buy a new phone? And the young guy looks at her and he goes, no, ma'am, you're going to be fine. I'll take care of it. She goes, see that, Hilda? He's going to take care of it. Oh, it's, she's the best. So I was about 8 years sober, and my partner and I decided that we would come live out in Southern California. My mom's health was on and off, and we came on a five-year plan. We stayed seven, and Southern California changed my entire sobriety. The sponsor I have today reminded me that page 77 says I'm to fit myself to be of maximum service to God and the people about me. It doesn't say in Alcoholics Anonymous. It says God and the people about me, and I had missed that somewhere along the way. And when I got Sharon as my sponsor and Pacific Group as my home group, everything changed. I've never been busier in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And in 2008, my partner was having some visa troubles, so we went back to Ireland for a year. And I did not get on well in Ireland, but I'm well trained in Alcoholics Anonymous. Phone my sponsor every day. I phoned her every day from Ireland. And finally I said, look, Sharon, I don't know what to do. And she said, I think maybe it's time you get on a plane. And I hung up the phone, and my Julie said to me, what did Sharon say? And I said, she told me to get on an effing plane. And she said, do you need a lift to the airport? Because we knew we'd work it out. It's Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. So I came back to Southern California. I was 15 and a half years sober, jobless, penniless, sleeping on my mom's floor. Not where I wanted to be at 15 years of sobriety. And it was dark, and I couldn't get a job. And I was talking to Sharon one day, and I said to her, look, I don't know what I'm going to do. You know, I can't give my mom any money, and I just feel dreadful. I can't seem to get a job. And Sharon said to me, hang on a minute. Aren't you and your mom watching certain television shows together every week? I said, well, yeah. She goes, hmm. And aren't you having dinner once a week together? I said, well, yeah. She goes, huh. Don't you think this is another way to make amends to your mother by allowing her to be a mother? I can see it now. You know, at the time I was like. But I threw myself in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got busy. And then Julie got back in the country, and, you know, we got better jobs and different apartments and nice cars, and life took off. And in 2011, the company I was working for was going under. So I called me mom. I said, Mom, this company I'm working for is going under. I'm going to be out of a job again. And my mom went, you can come live with me. It took her 24 hours to realize I'd given her bad news. She phoned me the next day, oh, I'm sorry about your job. You know? So in 2012, I was up for two jobs at the same time. One was with unmanned drones for the military, and the other was with the Spirit of Giving. Now, if you've had more than a 10-minute conversation with me, you know I am an unmanned drones for the military kind of girl. My sponsor, who's an ex-bong wine drinking hippie, said, oh, I think the Spirit of Giving would be really good for you. And I was being a smartass, and I said, why don't we let God decide? And she said, I think that's a fantastic idea. So we agreed I would take whoever offered me the job first. So I ended up working at the Spirit of Giving company, where they had slides from the second floor to the first and Barefoot Fridays. It was an adjustment for me, let's say. I think it was the end of my first week, some guy walked by me and said, lose the blazer. I was like, but this company did this thing called One Day Without Shoes, where you go all day from the time you wake up to the time you go to bed without putting shoes on to bring awareness to people who don't have shoes, right? Now, I grew up in London, right? We don't wear flip-flops or Birkenstocks. It's too cold. So I have a thing. I'm quirky about my feet. And the people I work with knew I was quirky about my feet. You know, I don't even own a pair of flip-flops to this day. So they said to me, I tell you what, why don't you get a pedicure? It might make you feel a little bit more relaxed. You know, get your toes painted. I was like, I'll give it a go. I'd never done it before. So the day before, I go out at lunchtime, and I slink into this pedicure place, and I say to the woman, I'd like to have a pedicure. And she goes, pick a color! I'm picking a color, right? I end up with bright red because it's a color, and I'm sitting in the thing, and they put my feet in hot water, and I'm like, oh, this isn't so bad. I can do this. I'm all right. And then they come over and put my hands in hot water. I'm like, whoa, we're not doing the hands. Why are we putting the hands in hot water? Now the hands are in hot water. My feet are in hot water. This other woman comes over and goes, would you like a massage? I'm like, no. It was not a relaxing experience for me. So I'm chatting to one of my sponsees afterwards. And I said, geez, this pedicure thing, I don't know. And she goes, you had a pedicure and you didn't invite me? And I said, oh, how sweet is that, that she would want to go and support me? She goes, oh, no, I was going for the show. The other thing this company did was on your year anniversary and every 2 years after, you go to a third world country and you get to put shoes on little kids' feet. And I went to Honduras, and every morning, I was unplugged for 10 days, which is unheard of for me. And every morning, we get up and get in a van. And we ended up in this remote area of Honduras where the kids were direct descendants of the Mayans, and the government didn't acknowledge them. So their school had no electricity and very little running water, and happiest kids you'll ever meet. And we had a medic with us because these kids' feet were a mess, some of them, you know, because they don't have shoes. And I had a little fella whose feet were a mess, and the medic took him away, and he started to cry because he didn't think he was going to get his shoes. And my heart cracked open just a little bit. And as we were packing up to leave, I saw the little fella across the valley with his new shoes in his hands, giving me a wave. And my heart cracked open just a little bit more, because I am not that girl. I'm not that girl. And of course, the point is, I almost missed it. I am the product of strong sponsorship. I take direction from a woman I do not always like, but I respect, to do things that rarely make sense. You know, and it got me wherever. And in 2016, they had this big reorg. It wasn't personal, it was just business, and I lost my job. And I was leaving with my box at lunchtime, and my team, who were all very young, were coming in from lunch, and they started to cry when they saw me leaving. And I explained to them, it was just a reorg, it wasn't personal, this is business, you guys are going to be fine, you know. And I got in my car and I called my sponsor and I told her what happened. And I said, you know, I really worried about my team because, you know, it's their first time for a reorg and, you know, I've been through it. My sponsor goes, how amazing is that, that you care so much for your team? What a great change that is, Hilda. I was like, did you miss the part where I lost my job? But of course, she always wants that little bit more, you know. And and it took me a while to get another job, but I'd been here before. And I knew from experience now that I end up exactly where I'm supposed to, so I did not stress. In fact, I went to Ireland for 2 weeks with my partner, and she turned to me during the holiday and said, you know, I think this is the first time we've been on holiday in decades that you haven't had to check your phone every 10 minutes. You know, I enjoyed it. I had a good time. And I was up for a job in Canada. Big job, big title, big money. I am going to Canada. And I'd been up 6 times for interviews, and my sponsor kept saying, you need to keep interviewing locally. I was like, but I'm going to Canada. Okay. So I kept interviewing locally, and I kept going to Canada. And I interviewed with this company in Long Beach, and little company, but exciting things, and nice people. And a couple days later, they asked me to go down for a second interview, which is fine, because I'm going to Canada. And, you know, I got home that night, and the next day they called and they offered me a job for more money than I had asked for, which had never happened to me in my entire career. So I called Sharon, and I told her what happened with this company in Long Beach. I mean, they're in Long Beach. I'm going to Canada. And Sharon goes, I'm sorry, did Canada offer you the job? I said, well, not yet. She goes, but Long Beach offered you the job, right? I said, well, yeah. She goes, goodbye, Hilda. So So I took the job in Long Beach, and I called your man back in Canada and explained to them that I'd taken this other job, but thank you for the opportunity, and I really enjoyed it and liked the company, yada, yada, yada. And she called me back a few hours later, and she goes, look, the CEO would really like to have a conversation with you because he'd like to change your mind. And I said to her, without thinking, I said to her, you know, if he could change my mind, I'm not the kind of employee he wants. Right? Because I have a little bit of integrity today. You know, I love that thing, what good are principles if they're only applied when it's convenient? Right? So I told her, you know, I'd already made this commitment. And she called me a few hours later. Now he's really impressed and he really wants to talk to me. I'm like, he missed the whole point, you know. So I've been working at Long Beach for a couple of years, and it's a good job, and I really like it, and I'm really good at it. And about 4 months ago, the company in Canada got bought out, and the whole executive team got fired. It's a little thing. It makes me happy. But it just solidifies that I always end up exactly where I'm supposed to, right? it's a funny old thing. So a couple of months ago, my mom was having some trouble, and she went to the doctor, and he said they're going to have to redo her. She had a double mastectomy, and she had a rebuild or whatever you call that, and they were going to have to do the same operation again. And, you know, I said to her, we've been here before. We can do this. You know, it's going to be fine. And it was scary for her, and because it'd been almost 20 years since we've been through it before, you know. And I said to her, you know, I'm delighted I get to go through this with you. We can do this because we've done it. And, you know, I took my mom to the doctors that morning, and they were doing the operation. And when I was talking to her, she said, it feels different this time. And I said, you know, it is different this time because now we know it's going to be okay. No matter what happens, my mom and I are good. There is nothing left unsaid between us. You know, she knows it, and I know it. And I'm grateful to Al-Anon for those of you who are here, because without Al-Anon, my mom and I would have no relationship. You know, and you know, it was all good. It was all benign, and she came through. And you know, now she's having an operation on her ankle. I don't know, but we'll do that too. You know, I get to be of service to my mother. When I was 6.5 years sober, it felt like I had to, you know, and over time, and as much as I've grown in Alcoholics Anonymous, now I realize I really get to, and it is a gift. And, you know, I never had that opportunity with my dad, and my dad is, my dad always knew what I was, right? He was under no illusions. He had come to visit me once in Connecticut. I was working at that little company, and it was Christmas time, and I went to the Christmas party, and it was an open bar. And I was drinking Black Russians all night. And my boss was mortified, because I wasn't yet 21. And I was completely, completely gone by the end of the night. She had to call my father to come get me. And my dad was a big guy. And my boss kept apologizing. My dad literally threw me over his shoulder. And as he was walking out, I heard him say, don't worry, it's not the first time Hilda fought the Russians and lost. You know, you know, he knew. And my dad's buried in Arlington National Cemetery. And when I buried him, I was a train wreck. And I made a scene. And it was really a bad, bad day all around. And a few years ago, I had to go to Washington, D.C. For work, and Sharon said to me, perhaps it's time you do some graveside amends. Now, I had never believed in graveside amends. I thought they were kitschy, right? And I've heard people share about them, but I was like, whatever. I don't think so. So I said to Sharon, I'll do it because you're suggesting it, but I don't really believe in this kind of thing. And she goes, just do it anyway. You know, write your dad an amends letter and go to Arlington and do it at graveside. And I was like, fine. We go to Arlington National Cemetery. Now, when he died, they had given me a family pass, and I have moved all over the world drunk and sober. But when I was going to Washington, D.C., I put my hand straight on that pass, and that can only be God. And So we rented a car and we were driving into Arlington National Cemetery, and I put the little posse in the dash. And when we went through the gates, the guards at the gate jumped to attention and saluted. I didn't expect it. I drove straight to my dad's grave, which is amazing because I had no idea where it was before we went there. And you know, I did graveside amends at my dad's grave, and I realized something when I was standing there, that, you know, my dad would be proud of me today. Not because I've been of service to my mother. I've been of service in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I got my bachelor's or my master's, or that I've been in a healthy relationship for so long, or even that I've been sober this long. My dad would be proud of me today because all he really wanted was that I had a little bit of grace and dignity. I got that here from the examples in this room, you know. And it turned out to be such a powerful experience for me. Contempt prior to investigation or what, you know. But it was brilliant. And, you know, I know today everything is different. You know, everything is different. I am happy to be of service in Alcoholics Anonymous, but it is not why I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I really came to Alcoholics Anonymous to stay out of wet beds with ugly people. I mean, that's the truth. You know, when I turned 50, my partner and I have this whole thing about when we turn 50, you get to do whatever you want. So I wanted to jump out of a plane. So we went down to Paris, California, and five of my sponsees and my sponsor, if you know my sponsor, it's no shock, we all went skydiving. And we're all going up in the plane, and it was fantastic. You know, it was one of those moments where I looked around the plane and I thought, these people are closer to me than my own family will ever be, you know. And we went skydiving, and we had this picture taken together, and I just looked at my sponsor and said, you know, this is the kind of thing I sat in bar stools and looked at on television, said, I'm going to do that one day. And I couldn't get off the bar stool long enough to do anything. You know, I just couldn't get myself organized to do anything. And I got to go skydiving. And if you're new, it doesn't mean that you have to go skydiving if you stay sober. It's just an option, you know. And this last September, I took my my better half to Italy for her 50th. And every morning she listens to Gregorian chant with her morning meditation. And the one thing she wanted to do for her 50th birthday was go to this obscure little town in Norcia, Italy, where these monks do Gregorian chants three times a day. She listens to them on a CD every morning, and she wanted to see them live. And we went to this little village. It's actually where St. Benedictine is born. It's his little town. And his sister, who I didn't know was a saint, whatever, Scholastica. So we go to this little town in Italy, and we rented a car, and we went up to this tiny little monastery three times a day and heard these monks do Gregorian chant live and in person. And we went one day, we didn't know it was a holiday. It was a Catholic celebration day. It was one of those kind of obscure ones, not the big ones that we all know, because I'm Catholic and I didn't know this one. And we went in thinking it was going to be the 20 minutes of Gregorian chant, and it was a 2.5 hour full mass. And you know, I had one of those moments where I thought, you can't plan things like this. You know, when you feel truly touched by the Spirit, you know, I really feel like as I grow in sobriety, something is changing, and I'm open, you know, and I know that all of that is part of being of service. Getting in the car, you know. It's as simple as parking cars on Wednesday night, which is my commitment, you know, or making coffee, or, you know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I came to you a lying bedwetting whore, and somewhere along the way, you've turned me into a good friend, a loving and monogamous wife, and a true daughter to my mother. For that, I thank you. I don't know.